Affairs to order. It's about 5 minutes after nine on the 20th. Present we have Vice Chair Senator Giesel, Senator Coghill, Senator Wachowski, and myself, Chair Dyson. We have two bills and two resolutions before us today. The bills, SB 145 by the Governor, SB 127 by Senator Giesel, HGR 23 by Representative Millett, and HGR 19 by Representative Isaacson. It is my intention, with committee's approval, to move all four of these today, but we'll see how it goes. Please turn off your cell phones, or at least turn the ringers off. Mr. Barnhouse.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. That's right. Barnhill, Barnhouse, Barn, whatever. I'll respond to hey you if that works too. I want to thank you on behalf of the Governor Parnell administration for considering SB 145, our Veterans Update Bill. As Commissioner explained at your last hearing, the bill does a handful of things to update our laws with respect to treatment of veterans. So we have the hiring preference in our state personnel code. It updates the definition of veteran to include recent conflicts that followed the Vietnam War. That update also applies to Department of Commerce veterans loans, as well as Alaska Housing Finance Corporation access to housing projects. It also updates Alaska pension law to comply with the HART Act of 2008. That was a law that was enacted by Congress. HART Act stands for Heroes Earnings Assistance Relief Tax Act. And it ensures that a member, an active employee of an employer that participates in the public employees retirement system, teachers retirement system, or judicial retirement system, who is called into service and killed while performing qualified military service, their last day of employment will be deemed the date of death for purposes of pension benefits that the survivors would receive, such as accelerated vesting or ancillary life insurance benefits. Additionally, to comply with the HART Act, it defines differential wages. That's the difference between the wage that the employee receives in public employment versus the wage that they receive from the military. That's the differential wage. That will be construed under federal law as W-2 wages, and the employer will include that as wages paid to the employee for tax purposes. So that's, in a nutshell, that is the purpose of the bill. I have a wide array of individuals behind me, from Deputy Commissioner McHugh Pierre from the Department of Military Veterans Affairs, John Sherwood from the Department of Health and Social Services, Kathy Lee from the Division of Retirement Benefits, Nikki Neal from the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations, to answer any questions the committee may have.
Wow, you brought the A-team.
Absolutely.
I might add for the record that we have the A-team assisting us. Sam Greeley, Chris Dickrell, we really appreciate your service. The questions from the committee. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you, I'm just looking at page four, for instance, qualifications for loans, and talk lines 14 through 18. Can you talk about the last date? What would be the last date of Operation Iraqi Freedom? And then can you talk about what the time periods are that you have listed, that would be listed in 5 U.S.C. 21081?
Sure. That last date will be defined by the federal government. I do not know when that date will be. I do not believe it has been defined yet. The federal statute is a statute that defines veteran in much the same way that our statute does. The reason why we incorporate it into the bill, sorry, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the reason why we incorporate it into the bill is that federal law seems to be updated with respect to adding the conflicts on a more regular basis than state of Alaska law is. As you can tell from the bill, we haven't updated this since the Vietnam War. We've had quite a few conflicts since then. The federal government has updated that to include conflicts since the Vietnam War. If you pull that statute, it looks materially the same as our statute. It just has the initial Iraqi conflict, 1990 to 1992, and then Operation Iraqi Freedom added to it.
I'm just curious, if people are serving in Afghanistan, for instance, right now, or other parts of the world where they may be deployed, would those periods be covered?
What through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, what the bill does is it covers all service rendered during those time periods, wherever in the world that service occurs. San Francisco, Iraq, Afghanistan.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Deputy Commissioner Pierre from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Deputy Commissioner Barnhill and I have spoken about this, and working with the federal VA through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, OEF, Operation Enduring Freedom, which includes Afghanistan, is included in this definition, but it's not specifically named yet because that period of conflict, that location of conflict, is not completely finished. We expect a drawdown, full drawdown and removal from that conflict, and have that conflict date closed out in sometime in 15, calendar year 15, but we're not sure. Obviously, the president's going to have to make that call with Congress. So they are included in this bill, though, and in this definition through today.
Just to continue to clarify, is it location-based or time-based? In other words, let's say Operation Enduring Freedom is going on, but you're not deployed to a combat zone. You're deployed somewhere in the United States or somewhere, Thailand, let's say. Would you still be covered under this?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it depends on your job title and what you're doing. So, say if you're working in Nevada and you're flying remotely piloted aircraft, you are included in that. You are considered a combat veteran. So it depends on what job you're doing in the military. And Mr. Chairman, if I might add to that, every veteran's DD-214 is going to have that identifier on there. So if I were to come forward and I had a DD-214, you would be able to say, yes, this person is a combat veteran. No, this person is not. And each service branch will delineate that based on where you served and what time you served.
Senator Cargill?
I was just going to say, DD-214 is a document I have, and that's what I got when I separated from the military, just for what it's worth.
I'm sorry if I missed something, but have we or should we consider putting wording in here that whenever the feds change their classifications on a new conflict, that our statutes would follow that?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly what the bill proposes to do by incorporating by reference 5 U.S. Code 2108.
I'm sorry, I thought I'd missed that. All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Just Senator Wilkowski, to follow up on that, I guess the converse, are there other situations where we would not want to be bound by the federal government's definition that you can consider? I know we often don't like to listen to what the federal government has to say.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, McHugh Pierre again, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. That is a tricky question. Obviously, it's a case-by-case basis, and we believe in under this circumstance that the definition of combat veteran is one that, with the statute change and update, that we believe it follows the same policy that we've been at. So all the statutes refer to combat veterans. If we continue to reference the combat veteran language in the federal code, then we should be safe and we should be sure in that definition. I think in this case, it's something we should do.
Further questions? Comments from the committee?
One comment.
Certainly.
Just want to agree with the last conversation. I'm usually not a big fan of assuming by reference the federal code, because they do change things, but we are tied at the hip with them on this particular issue anyway. And I think if they change, as the testifier said, it's wise for us to make sure that our Alaskans get that. We change statutes so slowly, so yeah, I'm game, but normally I bristle at it.
All right, we have two people that want to testify. Mark Sansucci or Sushi in Tacoma, can you hear us, sir?
Mr. Chair and committee, yes, I'm Mark Sansucci, the Department of Defense Regional Liaison. I'm actually I'm calling in for the proposed amendment of Senator Willikowski, which I'm listening, and I know you haven't taken up yet.
All right. I'll stand by. Edna or Diane Irwin and Gary Bowling in Anchorage, I think you're just here for questions. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, this is Carrie Bowling with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation with Diana Irwin, and yes, we're just available for questions.
All right. Captain Pulaski in Anchorage, are you there, sir?
Yes, Senator Dyson, this is Captain Bob Pulaski, and I am available to give public testimony.
Go.
Okay. What I want to do is I want to point out I am a retired NOAA commissioned officer and a federally recognized veteran with service-connected injuries. I've provided written testimony, but I'll keep it very short. I appreciate your attention to the importance that our veterans bring to our nation and our state. And in reviewing this bill as an update to the Alaskan veterans laws, which appears, listening to Deputy Commissioner Barnhill, has not been updated since the Vietnam era, I ask you to consider bringing consistency between the present U.S. Code definitions and the Alaska statutes associated with veterans, armed forces, military service, and uniformed services. Specifically, I'm referring to Titles 10 U.S.C., which is the armed forces' title, Title 37 U.S.C., which is pay and allowances, and Title 38 U.S.C., which is veterans' benefits, as they apply to the definitions of active duty, military service, and uniformed services. I respect the difference right here of combat veterans and combat service versus in armed service versus active duty military uniform services. And as it pertains to the lower parts of the statute in front of you, I fully support the errors in the conflict. I'm just asking that the veterans' language be brought consistent with federal code. Let me give you my personal example. I work for the state. I'm very proud to work for the state and very appreciative of my position with the state. However, when I apply for a state position, I falsify my application if I claim to be a veteran. However, because I can't claim to be a veteran, I cannot claim to be a service-disabled veteran, even though I qualify under the state code as service-disabled veteran. So it's that inconsistency I see, and I see it doesn't only apply to me. I see an inconsistency that applies to the public health service. And I think I could go into lots of different details, but I think the most important thing to recognize is the public health service is the fourth largest serving active duty service in the state of Alaska, following the Coast Guard, Air Force, and Army. And they are deployed from Kotzebue to Ketchikan, providing medical services to the Coast Guard, as well as J-Bear, as well as the Indian Health Service and Environmental Engineering. So we're deployed, or they are deployed all over. The NOAA Commission Corps has been up here since 1917, its inception, doing survey and navigation work, as well as recent fishery independent surveys. Again, deployed, doing the nation's mission in uniform. So finally, I just want to conclude that as a lifetime member of the Military Officers Association of America, I've assisted the national legislative team on numerous issues, taking care of those serving and those who have served. At this stage of my life, this won't make a difference to me in the definition of veteran other than knowing the title, but also knowing that the members of the U.S. Public Health Service, the NOAA Corps, that choose to live in Alaska today and in the future will have the same benefits for their military service as those who had served in the armed forces. Thank you, and I'm happy for questions.
Any questions for Bob? All right, seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Questions or comments from the committee? Pierre, would you like to comment on Bob's testimony?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. For the record, McHugh Pierre again, DMVA. He does have some valid points, and I think that we could take a hard look at all of the locations of veteran separate from what is a combat veteran and then what is a veteran in general. And so this might be the vehicle, this might not be the vehicle, but it's something that I think that Deputy Commissioner Barnhill and I can sit down together and work through and see what the best fix is, because clearly Captain Bob did bring up some points that were not in this bill that are outside of the scope of this bill, and we need to better address that. So we'll give you a look and give you our recommendation, if that suits the chair.
Yeah. And where does this bill go next? Does it have a finance referral or directly to the floor?
Goes to the floor.
Yeah, that's right. So, and Commissioner Pierre, I think that Public Health Service and NOAA are not considered to be military veterans. Is that correct?
That's not entirely correct, Mr. Chairman. So they, once again, they get a DD-214 and they separate as well, that would give them veteran status. And so Captain Bob is an example of someone who is a service-connected veteran who at the VA says is a veteran. So the question where we have some discrepancies in our programs, and it might not even need to be fixed through statute. It could be something that we could fix through regulation that just says in personnel hiring, these people are included too because they've got that veteran recognition from the VA.
Right. Mr. Barnhill? Off the record.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, what? Excuse me. Just a moment. Are you going to offer a amendment, Mr. Wilkowski?
Yes, sir.
Senator?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd like to call my staff up, actually, if I could, Mr. Chair,
sure,
to give a brief presentation. It's a very short amendment. And do you have copies, Monica?
There should be copies.
Everyone have copies? I have a copy in mine.
Please.
Okay, I'd like to offer amendment number one, Mr. Chair.
I'll object for the purpose of discussion.
Do you have extra copies?
I'm not sure. I haven't found mine.
Mine
is
under additional material.
Okay, all right. All right, please continue.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I could have my staff, Monica, just give a very brief presentation, and then I think we have still have a witness on the phone who can testify a little bit more in depth. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Monica Southworth, staff to Senator Wilikowski. The amendment before you is it deals with Medicaid waivers and the wait list for military families. The issue arose out of a survey that was done by a national organization called STOMP, which works with military families that have special needs children. Oftentimes, the TRICARE ECHO program, which is a supplemental insurance program to TRICARE Standard and TRICARE Prime, does not always fulfill all of the needs that the families need, so they apply for a Medicaid waiver. There was in the survey, a lot of the comments revolved around saying respite care is not enough, the only option for our family was Medicaid, so there was a need for it. What happens is families will apply for the Medicaid waiver, and then they'll be stationed out of the state. The wait list in Alaska is about 4 years long, approximately 45 months. That's the average wait time for families applying for the Medicaid waiver for home and community-based care. And when they leave the state, they're removed from the waiting list. What we're proposing is that they remain on the waiting list as long as they intend to return to Alaska within 18 months of separation. That way they maintain the priority. We're not asking that services follow them out of the state. Alaska will not be sending any money out of the state. The families that would be affected by this, there are families at Eielson and at Jayberry that would benefit from this, but only as long as they return to the state. And we have Mark Sansuki available for comment. And this is listed as one of the top 10 issues for the DOD Legislative Liaison Office. I have a list here. I just printed it off, but it's listed as number 8. Waive required waiting time to establish residency for separating. Oh, that's the wrong one. Number 6, allow service members to retain their earned priority for received Medicaid, home, and community-based waivers.
Mr. Chair, this has a zero fiscal note. This does not cost anything to do. All it does is it preserves a place on a waiting list. And so if someone's deployed, if someone's transferred out of state, as long as they intend to come back and permanently reside in Alaska, they won't lose their position on the waiting list. That's all this does.
So. All right. And I think this is the very issue that Mark and Susie wanted to testify about. Are you still with us, Mark?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair. Yes, my name is Mark Sansusi. I'm the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for the Northwest, including Alaska. Monica just did a great job kind of synopsizing the problem. It bubbled up to become one of our key issues here in the last year because we've had lots of survey data showing that these special needs families move from one state to the other, and they start over from square one. And some of the states, not necessarily Alaska, they wait 2 to 6 to 8 years, and then they move while still serving and to another state, and they start over again. So we thought maybe the easiest way is to just have the legal residents of a state, in this case Alaskans, apply and when they're on active duty, and not and just kind of stay in the queue and stay keep their place. So when they separate and they come back home and they may be in between jobs and kind of in between medical coverage, they take their rightful place. And so we're not asking for a new entitlement or to bump anyone else off a list. We know that the family's dependent will get reevaluated because we know that the medical conditions, you know, can get better or worse. And we know that frequently those lists are based on, you know, the need and the acuity of the physical disablement. So this is kind of what we're hoping to accomplish. We have a bill in Washington State just passed the House this week, and we have some other activity in some other states looking to try and do this all with zero fiscal notes and really just trying to change policy a little to enable those people to stay on the list in their home state of residence. So I stand for any questions.
Yeah, thank you. Are there questions for Mark? Yeah, thank you, and thank you for the work you're doing. Mr. Barnhill? Commissioner?
Mr. Chair.
What's the administration's position on this amendment?
So, Mr. Chair, with regret, our department isn't yet the Department of Administration and Health and Social Services. And so I'm going to need to bring up Mr. Sherwood to speak to the mechanics of Medicaid waivers. And then I'd also like to have Mr. Pierre come up and speak to Department of Defense priorities.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Sherwood. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services, and we oversee the Medicaid home and community-based waivers. Just a little bit of background. When we talk about Medicaid waivers, these are services which are alternatives to institutional care. So you must meet that institutional care standard to qualify. Alaska currently operates 4 Medicaid waivers. Unlike the rest of the Medicaid program, which is, you know, could be called a pure entitlement, states are allowed to limit the number of people who are served on their waivers. 3 of our 4 waivers do not operate with any kind of waiting list whatsoever. If you're eligible, you go on them immediately. Those waivers serve people who meet nursing home level of care. For individuals who meet the level of care, intermediate level of care for individuals with intellectual disabilities, sometimes called ICF-IID, like our old Harborview institution that we used to operate in Valdez, there is a waiting list, and the DD registry serves as the waiting list. At any given time, there's approximately a little over 600 people on it right now. And people on that registry are ranked according to need. We pull about 20 people a month off that waiting list to provide service. So it's not really a time on the list. It's a need score that places your ranking. We think people who meet this institutional level of care, particularly people who have already met it, left the state and come back, would pretty much go back onto the registry at the top of the list. We don't see this really having a substantial impact of the flow on people to and from the waiver. I talked to my senior staff who work on this program. Neither one of them could recall an incident where this had been an issue. We may not always be made aware of families' concerns or how they choose to make decisions based on their perception of the wait list. So,
is there a downside to doing this?
At the numbers we see, we think this would minimally impact our program. It would probably take a little bit of effort on our part to restructure how people flow to make sure we capture that information, but we don't see a significant impact on our program.
Yeah, and Dyson, I certainly know with the permanent fund dividend program, there's a huge issue who stays qualified and who doesn't, and who is their Alaskan immigrant, who really means they're coming back, and all those sorts of things. Would it be an issue for you to try to have to qualify who is a legitimate Alaskan who should stay on the list in the rare circumstance where this comes up?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so. I mean, I think we would probably give people the benefit of the doubt if they provided a reasonable case to us.
And came back,
yes. As was mentioned in the prior testimony, they still have to go through a thorough application process and be determined to qualify for Medicaid and meet the institutional criteria for the waiver. So it's not automatic. Right. There's still a process that has to be done.
Question to committee or Senator Coggin.
Sure. And that process is probably not a slow, fast process. It's rather slow, I would think. So if you had this in the books, and most of us want to support those who want to come back to Alaska, but given the circumstance where you had two people with similar needs and somebody had been here in Alaska waiting for services, trying to get to the front of the line, and a military family came, would this tip the scale?
Hey, excuse me, I'm not sure I understood your question.
If I had two people that had the same need, mm-hmm. scored similarly, one stayed in Alaska waiting for services, another one just came back from separating from the military, would this particular amendment tip the scale on your scoring?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, we draw people based on a numeric score, and so two people with the same score would get drawn at the same time. I have to confess, I don't know what the tiebreaker is. I believe if we, as I said, we draw about 20 people a year. If there's two people with the same score at the or 20 people a month. If there's two people with the same score, I believe we take them both, and we just take one extra that month. So if there's a tie like that, I don't think we actually...
To continue, Senator Coghill?
It seems to me, from at least looking into this world a little bit, that generally speaking, these services are kind of the last best hope that a family is going to get to help them really survive. And my guess is, even though we have a pretty significant wait list and we could do more, we still provide some pretty good services. I think there's many communities stepping up. So would this be a draw to the military, or would it just be just a convenience factor if they decided to come back?
Identify yourself, please.
Through the chair, John Sherwood, Division of Senior Disability Services. I don't know that I could characterize. I think once you've served here, if you make a decision to keep the state as your residence, there are a number of supports in the state. In addition to the waiver program, the infant learning program supports through the school district. You would look at the availability of whatever other specialty care you might need. You'd sort of make a formed decision on a number of dimensions. This might influence a decision. I think when I first heard of this proposal, my immediate concern was, do we do enough to inform families about how our wait list really works? That it's really not a time wait list, so people don't get the impression that they might have to really, start back at the beginning. And it was mentioned the average length of time on the wait list. That is true, but also at any given time, approximately a quarter of our people have the lowest score possible in terms of ranking. They're basically people who don't identify imminent needs. So they may be receiving other services through the school district, through the infant learning program. We also have a state grant program that provides some services for people with developmental disabilities. I apologize for rambling a bit, but I just think it's probably a complicated decision. It's hard for me to think that this would be, the single biggest influence in that kind of decision.
I just bring it up because, for those who are waiting for kind of the most intensive services, mm-hmm. I don't want them to think that we're just going to have people move in and bump them off, but it really is based on need. And, with all due respect to the military, I think we should try to assimilate them, help them every way we can. But there are those quite often that sitting at home also, and I wanted to make sure that they were treated as fairly and equally as we possibly could. And I think I got a pretty good idea where we're at.
Further questions, Mr. Sherwood? Commissioner Pierre?
Senator Dyson, I have nothing further to add unless the committee would like to reference any questions from our department.
So the Military and Veterans Affairs does not have a position on this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, McHugh Pierre again for the record. I think that for the committee's information, we've done a tremendous job as a state making sure that we identify all the top 10 priorities. As Senator Wilkowski has pointed out, they come through every year, and the legislative liaison office at Department of Defense builds a list that they push forward to Congress, and then they also give to the regions to influence states in that region. And we are oftentimes with or ahead of that list. We do a tremendous job, and the military corporate structures know that and say, good job. My only concern specifically for this amendment reference this bill is that the bill deals with a specific cleanup language. This amendment isn't necessarily, in my view, in line with what the bill is trying to accomplish. I think it has good merit. It stands on its own. And that's just the way I kind of see things lining up with this discussion. So.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Further questions of these two witnesses? Senator Wilkowski, are you satisfied that your amendment fits with the title?
I think it does, Mr. Chair. I think this, I know when this was initially proposed, it was proposed as sort of a military omnibus bill. I think I was very careful. I've got a number of other military bills that have fiscal notes. I was very careful not to try to put one of those in. I think what they're trying to do with this bill is to try to make Alaska a little bit more attractive for active duty and veterans and honor their services, and that's what this does. And there's a requirement that the service member has to return within 17 months after separating. So it's not, if you have an active duty member who comes to Alaska and gets deployed somewhere, goes out of state, I think it's fair if we have a 600-person waiting list and they're number 400 on the list, that as the list moves down, they continue to have their spot. We're drawing 20 people a month. That's roughly a three-year waiting list, a little bit less. But
right. Senator Wilkowski, have you had legal analysis on whether this fits under the...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's because what you're doing in the first part of the amendment is you're... It's not a bill that came from the House, so there's not a title change. I mean, it fits within the title. You have to insert a provision, and that's what we do on page one of the amendment, to slightly change the title, but it's within the subject of, so it's, there's no constitutional issues, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, you're right.
Senator Dyson.
Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, a week ago, approximately, the Key Campaign folks were here. And I probably had six or eight of these parents in my office talking about the wait list and how heartbreaking it was for them to persevere through that wait list until their opportunity came up. And while this may have merit for the military folks and may not substantially change who moves up on that list, nevertheless, the perception, I fear the perception of my constituents who are desperately waiting for their turn for this waiver program. And therefore, Mr. President, I'm going to be a no vote on the amendment because I don't want those families to feel that they've been pushed aside, that someone else could possibly take a priority over them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could I respond to that, Mr. Chair?
And
I certainly respect that opinion, and I appreciate it. And I guess the point that I would add is these are people who are Alaskan residents, and they are being required by our government to go out of state. So I think there's an important distinction. We did this just last year with the permanent fund dividends. We said, if you're forced to be out of state because the government sends you out of state, we make an exception for you. We don't disregard, we appreciate that service. We understand that service, but they're being forced by the government to leave the state. All we're saying is you leave the state, we're going to continue to allow you to stay on the list, and when you do return, when you separate from service, you're going to come back and you're going to keep your spot on the list. It's very similar to what we did with the permanent fund, Mr. Chair.
Senator Cogan. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask one more question of the department that manages that. First of all, it was my understanding that it's based on need, not on time. So at this point, it's not a matter of holding a place. So the question I would have for the Health and Social Services is, if they had an application in to be on a Medicaid waiver and got those waiver services, if the family was maybe at a home of record during deployment but wanted to move back, would that waiver follow them? Would they have to go through the whole reapplication process? And would this amendment help them get that waiver quicker?
Through the chair, this is John Sherwood with the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Senior and Disability Services. We maintain the DD registry, and we also have to do Medicaid eligibility. With respect to Medicaid eligibility, this would not do anything about accelerating a Medicaid eligibility determination. When somebody leaves the state, ceases to be on Alaska Medicaid, when they come back, we have to have them reapply and re-verify all the basic criteria. Based on the way we score individuals, it's kind of a complicated scoring process that I will confess I do not know in detail. My understanding is this would not materially affect their score. It would perhaps move them through the registry process a little bit quicker. I think we'd have to look at
what kind of processes we set up to see if that just how much impact right now people get on the registry within about 30 days. So it might help speed that up, make that even shorter. But that's the part of the process I think it would have the most impact.
So the way I understand it, they would have to apply for the Medicaid, because that's right, it's a state-run program with federal partnership.
That's correct. Through the chair, just if I didn't answer, that waiver is not portable. If they move to another state, they do not take those waiver services with them.
So once they come back to Alaska, they have to reestablish. And so this may give them a little bump because we are expecting to treat them as somebody who would have applied in Alaska if they could have. And with that, maybe there is a benefit to the amendment that might be helpful. You know, we send them off with some expectation that we're going to receive them back as graciously as we can. This might be one way of doing it. Other than that, I don't see any great material benefit to this because it's mostly qualification, not time. And so I think the amendment of saying holding a place in line doesn't help. So the verbiage in this probably would be complicated. So the other question I would have, Mr. Chairman, is do we, by putting timelines in here, make it more difficult for those who may not fall into the timelines specified in this amendment? Other states may have those need for timelines. I don't know that we do. So, Mr. Sherwood, is there anything in the timelines in this that would add to the complexity of it?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, where there are timelines, we would have to do some degree of verification. However, in terms of how the family experienced it, as there is no durational requirement, residency requirement for Medicaid, this would not give an individual a particular advantage of meeting the residency requirement more quickly. People who did not meet those timelines would come in, they would move through the registry process, receive a score, and be placed on that registry based on that score, and essentially compete against the other individuals on the registry. So I don't think that it would have a significant detrimental impact to people who didn't meet the timelines.
Further discussion? Comments? I'm going to maintain my objection. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Beasel?
No.
Senator Coghill?
No.
Senator Stedman is absent. Senator Wilkowski?
Yes.
Chair Dyson?
Please. Back on the record, yes.
Chair Dyson, yes. Two yeas, two nays.
All right. The amendment fails. What's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 145, version 28-GS2585/A from this committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
The objection? Seeing none. SB 145 passes out. We'll take a break. Mr. Barnhill. Record, we have before us a bill previously heard, Senate Bill 127. Sir.
To the chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Forrest Wolf. I'm staff to Senator Kathy Giesel. We've already heard this bill previously, obviously. I'd like to really quick start off with, I think last time in the hearing it kind of came across as though we were unfairly bashing DMV, and I just wanted to quickly acknowledge that that wasn't our intent. We were simply trying to demonstrate the volume of work that is done in the private sector by a lot of these business partnerships. The DMV has made great strides in the past years to increase their efficiency through former Director Dwayne Bannock's Advanced Business Partnership Program, which he aggressively pursued down to current Commissioner Amy Erickson and a lot of the online stuff they're doing with webcams, enabling to see, you know, the lines that are currently at the DMV, as well as the ticket system, which I think greatly increases its efficiency as well. So I just wanted to get that on the record first and foremost. I think one of the hang-ups that we had in the committee hearing last time was that there was some sort of implication that these businesses are already receiving income from the state, and so therefore why should they be receiving more income from the state? And then also, you know, if they're already able to charge fees above and beyond what the state's charging, you know, what's the need for their more money? And that's not the issue. The issue isn't how much money these businesses are charging for these transactions. This, you know, that happens in the free market, and that should be up to the free market. It's not really the state's concern. The issue is that there is a large volume of work that's being done by the private sector for the state, for which they're receiving no compensation from the state at this time. So I think this this bill, once again, is about fairness. There's other programs set up in other departments that are similar to this, where the state is directly compensating the businesses, and I think that's it's only fair that we apply that to the volume of work that's being done by these advanced business partnerships for the DMV.
Questions or comments from the committee? What you said didn't make sense to me. When you said they're already receiving money from the state, you mean the surcharge that they put on the delivery of the service?
I said through the chair, Mr. Chair, they're not receiving any compensation from the state.
Okay, but they are receiving whatever surcharge they put on for the delivery of the service.
Through the chair, that's correct.
All right. Let's see, is anybody from DMV here? Would you come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amy Erics, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. I feel better knowing that no one was bashing DMV. I wanted to say a few words about the legislation. We hadn't had a chance to speak with the sponsor personally before I testified by phone last week, so I just wanted to put a few points on record. And that is that DMV supports making official its practices of partnering with private business to conduct title and registration services. But we provide the business partners with all of the supplies needed to conduct title and registration services, including license plates, month and year tabs, forms, driver manuals, and handicap placards, all free of charge. The DMV also provides free training to process transactions and free VPN access to all the agents to access the DMV database. The business partners charge a fee to customers that are not regulated or even disclosed to DMV, and some even benefit from the supplies that are free at a DMV office, including handicap placards and driving manuals. While the business partners make up approximately 26% of DMV revenues, these businesses do not function autonomously. DMV staff touches each and every transaction conducted by a business partner, and we have a staff of 7 to oversee and support their everyday operations. And even with DMV support, they too make errors that DMV must resolve, and they're still paid by the customer regardless of the mistake or the accuracy of their transactions. We serve as a de facto help desk for the business partners and spend hours reviewing documents and correcting documents. And some of the errors can be serious and time-consuming to correct. Some of the business partners have even registered a golf cart and a dune buggy for highway use, which has resulted in litigation for the DMV. And that's not to say that DMV doesn't also make mistakes, but I did want you to know that we do support the business partners in many ways. In my earlier testimony, I mentioned that the business partnerships are comprised of storefronts that provide the services, car dealerships, financial institution, commission agents that serve the smaller communities, driving schools, school bus contractors, tour and truck companies that administer road tests, and hospitals and medical facilities that issue disabled parking permits. Our original fiscal note only address what we consider the 11 for-profit storefronts, but I think after reading the information in the bill packet, which was a letter from the auto dealers, that this might also be applying to car dealerships and financial institutions that conduct these same transactions. So I think that would affect our fiscal note, and we will be submitting a new one to the next committee if it does indeed address the financial institutions and car dealerships.
I'm sorry. Replate the last sentence again for me.
We would need to submit a new fiscal note if this bill really does include the car dealerships that do their own title and registration transactions, in addition to the financial institutions that do the same. We had not included that in our original fiscal note. But they would also benefit from the up to 15% of the proceeds if they, too, are included in this bill, which I think they are based on the auto dealer's support of the bill.
Can you give, when one of these independent partners does part of the work that would go back to you, to your, at what point do they start saving you money because you have less staff time and so on?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that. I could try and get it penciled out for you.
Yeah, I would think that your folks, you know, in an office do six transactions an hour or 16, and so you would know in a day that they, you know, do 150 or whatever it is, and then, so that's what one person produces, and if a dealer does 150, they save you arguably a day's pay for, you know, payroll and benefits and so on.
And I'd be happy to get back to you on that.
Well, but indeed, a fiscal note ought to reflect, you know, both the revenue you don't leave and perhaps at some point expenses that you don't have to incur.
I see.
But I think we asked you on the record the last time we had this bill, what's DMV's support or not support this bill?
Mr. Chairman, DMV absolutely supports the idea of putting into statute these business contracts. We do it now. We'd be happy to put it into statute and build regulations that would make it more cohesive, I guess. And as to the fees that the state pays, that's really a policy call that I can't comment on.
All right. questions or comments from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I want to reiterate what we discussed last time. Department of Fish and Game, of course, contracts with Fred Meyer, Walmart, etc. So we've talked now about the larger reach of this into auto dealerships. Those folks were just here earlier this week, and many of those dealerships are considering dropping providing this service of titles and so forth, basically doing DMV work because it is costing them so much in personnel cost. It's great that the paperwork and all of that is provided, but as you know, running a private business, personnel costs are your highest liability, right, in operating a business. It was interesting to me to look at AS 281431E, ECHO, and find that the DMV, you may realize this when you renew your tag for your license plate, they're also collecting local taxes for the government in which you live, correct? Well, as the statute points out, the department, that's the DMV, retains 8% of those tax fees as administrative costs to the local government for collecting the taxes for them. So while DMV may be saying that it's inappropriate for private businesses to be retaining some of this money, they themselves retain money for collecting tax fees for local governments. Just to point out that there is this issue as well.
Gooses and ganders.
Sort of.
Or foolish consistency. All right. Further?
No.
All right. In discussions with the bill sponsor and also Finance Committee co-chair, as I understand it, the bill sponsor is comfortable with our committee recommending a finance referral. And if indeed the Finance Committee chooses to take it up, I would suggest that they may want the very kind of information we ask about. All right. Is there any further questions or discussion? I see Duane Bannock is online in Kenai. Duane, are you there?
Good morning, Senator Dyson. I am. I'm just here to answer any questions or provide any clarification of my earlier statements.
All right. And the other folks that are online in Wasilla and Anchorage, I understand, are just there to ask questions. Are there any of you that want to speak to this bill? All right, thank you. Seeing and hearing none, let's see. We will move this bill, and I think, given you being the sponsor, I'll make the movement. So I move that we move Senate Bill 145 from State Affairs with the individual recommendations. Is there objection?
Mr. Chairman, 127.
I'm sorry, you're right, 127. It's been a bad day. I move that motion to move the committee substitute for SB 127 from Senate State Affairs with individual recommendations. Is there objection?
And the attached fiscal note, Mr. Chairman?
And the attached fiscal notes. Note, yes. All right. Thank you. Seeing no objections, moved. We'll take a brief at ease. We'll take a House Joint Resolution 23. Please identify yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Turner. Staffer Representative Sharice Miller apologizes for not being able to attend today's hearing. The resolution before you, HJR 23, will mark the 50th anniversary of the Good Friday earthquake this March 27, 2014. The 9.2 magnitude quake tore apart about 50,000 square miles of south central Alaska and leveled entire communities and triggered massive tsunamis that brought even more devastation to the coastal areas. The purpose of House Joint 23 is not to highlight the earthquake or the destruction, but to honor the thousands of Alaskans who put the needs of others before their own needs following the quake. First responders, medical personnel, the Army, the Alaska Army and Air National Guard, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, government employees were joined by everyday Alaskans to conduct search and rescue operations, provide medical care, food, shelter, and the restoration of vital services and infrastructure. It was their selfless determination that saved unknown numbers of lives and rebuilt South Central communities before the return of winter that year. HJR 23 recognizes how a great disaster brought out the best of all Alaskans by proclaiming March 27, 2014 as Good Friday Earthquake Remembrance Day. Representative Millett respectfully asks for the committee's support for the legislation so it can be included in the events marking the 50th anniversary of the quake that will be taking place in Anchorage and other communities around South Central Alaska. I'd like to point out on your desk, Mr. Chairman, I did get a letter of support in late last night from Valdez Mayor David Cobb in support of the resolution. We also have a support letter of support in your packet from Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan. I'd also like to point out, Mr. Chairman, that on the phone is Mr. Chuck Vellante, an Alaska Air Guard veteran who brought the idea for the resolution to Representative Millett. And he served at Coolis Air Base during the earthquake and is one of the individuals honored under this resolution. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, comments, from the committee? Mr. Vellante, can you hear us, sir?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, thank you for bringing this forward. We'd be glad to hear your testimony. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Charles Valenti. I am a former member of the Alaska Air National Guard, and I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity. I wish to thank Representative Millett for her compassion, humanitarian efforts, and for orchestrating overwhelming House support for this resolution that honors Alaska state history. And again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senate committee members for the opportunity to speak on this tragic historical event, one that only affected all Alaskans, but also carried death and destruction far beyond its Alaska borders. Today, much is known about the Alaska earthquake of 1964. It's measured 9.2 magnitude strength, and widespread areas of death and destruction are widely published and appear across a variety of written and electronic media. There are thousands of pictures and equally countless testimonials. Mine is but one, and my family one of the lucky ones. The best way to describe my experience is to say that most of us know what a bull riding contest looks like. A rider sitting atop a massive, jumping, jolting, and twisting beast that is doing everything possible to dislodge the rider, a rider who is hoping to last the required 8 seconds. If you can imagine that, then you will know what I and countless thousands of others went through, not for 8 seconds, but for almost 4 minutes, where seconds seem like hours. On March 27, 1964, I was the flight dispatcher at Kulas Air National Guard Base in Anchorage, a position I held as part of a small contingent of civilian employees, less than 100, and an Air National Guardsman. That evening, I arrived home from Kulas just about 5 p.m. and waited for my wife and son to return home. Suddenly, in the fading light of day at 5:36 p.m., all hell broke loose and Alaska was forever changed. I bolted for the door and tried desperately to get out to reach the screams of my neighbor and her daughter, but try as I may, there was no way of standing, so I sat pinned to the floor with both hands tightly wrapped around the entryway doorknob, waiting and praying for the violent shaking to end. Finally, after what seemed an eternity, it stopped. I jumped up, ran next door, entered, checked on the women. Once I saw they were all right, I ran back outside, just in time to see my wife pulling into the driveway with her 6-month-old son, strapped in his car seat. She said when the quake started, it felt like a flat tire, and promptly pulled to the curb, but soon realized this was a massive quake and not a flat tire, and she watched in horror as plate glass windows of a store crashed to the sidewalk, and people who sprang out of the openings being knocked to the ground. We exchanged hugs, some quick comments, and went back into our home. There was no structural damage, but plenty of disarray. It took a few minutes to see that she and our son had the basic necessities. Then I immediately turned to her and said, I have to leave. I have to get to Kulas. She was visibly shaken, but a strong woman, she replied, go, fully realizing there would be those in desperate need. I ran to the car and sped toward Kulas, jumping several divisions in the road, and all the time wondering if there might be one I wouldn't be able to overcome. But God was gracious, and within 15 minutes I made it without mishap. By now, Alaska Air Guard and Army National Guard troops were converging on Kulas en masse. We immediately set about doing what we had long been trained to do, and that was to expend all efforts to alleviate and mitigate the suffering being experienced by countless citizens of Alaska, wherever that took us. Anywhere from freeing two souls trapped in the rubble of a collapsed Anchorage International Airport tower, to sending troops throughout neighboring communities to recover the dead, provide for the injured, free those still trapped, and to maintain civil order. And finally, to forge efforts to put humanitarian relief flights in the air. That day, in the bond of human compassion, we stood shoulder to shoulder with thousands of first responders. It was like unlike anything ever seen before. They came from all walks of life, beginning with your next-door neighbor, to those described within this resolution. Many self-sacrificing people went into unstable, known circumstances as they sought to render aid and assistance to those in desperate need. Tragically, later, some would pay the ultimate price. The quake and tsunamis, though ravaging, destructive, and deadly as they were, is not the main focus of this event. The cornerstone to this day remains the people of Alaska. Their strong will of resilience, resolve, tenacity, and their unabated selfless sacrifice became their legacy. That is what we should never forget, never take for granted, and always remember. However massive and tragic as this event was, there remains a common thread that was even stronger and more pervasive than all of that. It was the enduring spirit that found embedded within the milk of human kindness. On March 27, 2014, at 5:36 p.m., in an act of honor and tribute, church bells across Alaska will toll in memorial to all we have spoken of here today. Ladies and gentlemen of the Senate, your support of this resolution and its ultimate passage will ensure its rightful place in Alaska state history. I close by saying that I dedicate all efforts I have thus far expended to those who perished, those who suffered great loss, to the thousands who selflessly served, and to those who paid the ultimate sacrifice and are mentioned within this resolution and the families that they left behind. If there are any questions of me at this time, I am more than ready to respond.
No, I think not, but thank you, sir, for your service then. And just a reminder, I just found out yesterday that there will be a symposium of earthquake experts from all over the world. 1,000 of them will be gathering in Anchorage this spring. And I suspect our earthquake will certainly be a part of that discussion. Did you happen to serve with Herb Bredo in the Air Guard?
As a matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, I did, and I do have a letter that was written by his wife to me following his passing that I want to give to the historian at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson.
Yeah, as I remember,
I will do that when I'm in Alaska in that week of March 27th.
Yeah, they were very good friends. She has passed on as well, and my family were certainly tried to be a comfort to her when he died out Cape Romanzoff, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, sir.
Yeah. All right.
Matter of fact, the evening I arrived on site at Coolis Air National Guard Base, Herb was there, quite excitable, telling me that. The place where he lived, which was then known as Turnigan by the Sea, had several blocks of it had collapsed down into the mud flats of Turnigan Arm and Cook Inlet. And he said that that particular landslide stopped only two blocks from his home.
Yeah.
And then we went about doing our business. But he, yes, it was a very good friend.
Me too. So when you're in town, maybe we can sit and talk. Thank you. This bill, resolution, I'm sure, will pass out of here. I'm going to set this bill aside for a few minutes till our quorum returns, and we'll take up HGR 19. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the, and for the record, I'm Doug Isaacson, representative from House District Number 1, North Pole and Eielson Air Force Base. I appreciate having the opportunity to bring HGR 19 before you for your passage. I know it's a bill very similar to one that you've already passed out and have had unanimous support on the floor. HGR 19 is a very important bill to Alaska's economy and security. It's already identical, as I mentioned, to SGR 19, 14. And it's had only minimal amendments that do not change the purpose of the resolution. On page 3, you'll find on line 13, the word is added, and all bases in Alaska. Similarly, on page 3, line 14, is added, on all bases in Alaska. And then on page 3, line 21, we've included copies to be sent to Lieutenant General Russell J. Handy, who wears 3 strategic hats, as mentioned. Because you've unanimously passed this bill, I won't belabor all the benefits, but I do want to add 2 items. One is there's been questions about, with Flint Hills closure, is that going to affect the military jet fuel supply? That will not directly affect, no, because Petrostar has the contract for military jet fuels, and as a matter of fact, we're looking at ways of helping encourage them to have a railroad spur that can then go and supply J-Bear with military jet fuels and expand their mission and hopefully mitigate some of the negative results of Flint Hills closure. The other is I want to point out that we have had added today a letter of support from the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, which I believe you have in your packet. Anything further, Mr. Chair, I'll wait if you have questions. And thank you
questions
for
your support. Comments from the committee? I think you have a significant group of supporters here. Mr. Luke Hopkins, Mayor of Fairbanks, North Star Borough, are you on, sir? Luke Hopkins in Fairbanks, can you hear us?
This is Mayor Luke Hopkins.
Thank you, Ed, for calling, and I assume you're in support of this resolution?
Yes, absolutely. I can speak to it, but I believe I'm on the record from previous testimony in other committees, so I'll certainly be glad to answer any questions on this.
Well, thank you. Are there questions for Mayor Hopkins? You've just shown some judicious judgment. We're getting up against the timeline here, and if you waxed verbose, you might inhibit the progress of this bill, at least this day. But thanks for your support and the work you do there. Is there any further questions or comments? The chair will entertain a motion on this resolution.
Thank you, Mr.
HR 19.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move committee substitute for House Joint Resolution 19, version 28, LS1051-C, from this committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, HR 19 passes. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign this, and then we will take up HJR 23. HJR 23.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Joint Resolution 23, version 28-LS1038-C, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Objection? Seeing none, HJR 23 is passed from committee with individual recommendations. We are adjourned. When do we meet next?
Tuesday.
We'll see you guys Tuesday.